All right, we are live with Alexander McCurse in London. Alexander, how are you doing today?
I'm very well. I'm delighted to be back, though we're going to have dramatic events, I suspect, playing out, and those might be rather concerning in all sorts of ways, but it's always a pleasure to do live streams.
Yes, it is always a pleasure to be live. Always a pleasure to connect with everyone on Odyssey and Rumble and YouTube and our Durant community on Locals as well. How is everyone doing in the Locals chat, the durant.locals.com? A big shout out to our moderators for today. Zariel is in the house. And who else is in the house? Brett is with us as well. And those are our moderators for now. So, Alexander, what do we have going on in the world today? As I look through some of the questions that have already come in, we will answer all of the questions. Haruku, thank you for that super chat. Stammer is in China. Just last week, he was saying that China was enemy number one, wasn't he? And now he's in China talking about the great relations and history between China and the UK. What are your thoughts on that?
Which is richly ironic. I was talking to somebody from China actually just yesterday, and they told me that in fact, in China, for all sorts of very good historic reasons, which we might even discuss at some point, the imperial history is not very favorable. Anyway, the Chinese actually do not like Britain very much, and that the consensus there is that he's come to China cap in hand because he needs Chinese money and he's not going to get any. That's what this person said. And as I said, a very well-connected person from China indeed. But anyway, he's there.
Is that what he's doing there?
Yeah, that's what he's doing. He's looking for money. I mean, that's all it is. I mean, he's trying to get money because the British government hasn't got any and the economy is sagging and everything is going from bad to worse. I spoke to a very friend of mine who's a very high-end estate agent. You know him. He tells me that the property market in London is sagging. It's going down. And if you know anything at all, it's both a barometer of the state of the London economy and also a prop of the London economy. So the property market is going down. That is a very, very bad sign. So that's why he's there. Meanwhile, his political position implodes, as we've discussed in programs, and people are becoming increasingly angry and very disillusioned, and the Labour Party's in pieces, and it looks like their position in Manchester is about to collapse, and well, we've discussed that in the program. So that's why he's in China, based briefly. He's trying to prop himself up. It's beyond the point where he can.
What's going to happen with Iran, Alexander?
Well, I would remind everybody at this point that directly after the 12-day war, when the 12-day war ended, we said that this was just one round. There would certainly be another strike fairly soon, a bigger, more powerful one than the one we saw in June. I thought it would come before the end of 2025. Well, it's now coming a month into 2026 instead. So we didn't get that timing that wrong. And I think it's inevitable that there is going to be another strike. And the reason is because none of the things that were attempted in June were resolved. There was attacks on the nuclear facilities, but that was always ultimately a regime change operation. And the regime survived the June attack. It survived the January protests. So now, of course, they're moving towards the next attempt, which is another military strike. The options are difficult and complicated because Iran is a big, very complex society, as we've discussed many times. But that's not going to stop them. They're going to try in some way, and we'll see what they do. But a strike definitely is coming.
Where is everyone joining us from? See a lot of people from all over the world joining us on this live stream. What is happening with Ukraine, Alexander? I'm a little bit shocked because BlackRock Mertz is now saying no to Ukraine being fast-tracked into the EU. And I figured that if there would be anyone that would support Ukraine being fast-tracked into the EU, given that there's trillions of dollars provisioned for Ukraine reparations and reconstruction and military weapons purchases, it would be BlackRock Mertz. But now he's saying, nope, there's going to be no fast track of Ukraine.
There's going to be
what is going on here?
He's talking about, he's even talking about starting talks with the Russians, even, of course, as at the same time they're banning.
What is BlackRock telling
Russia?
What is he up to?
What is happening? I think that despite all the brave words, all the rhetoric, despite the hopes that may have existed around the talks that took place, I'm going to say it, actually, I think the talks played a very big role, because, again, I think there was more attempts to bounce the Russians or bully the Russians or tempt the Russians into concessions over Ukraine. That hasn't happened. There was attempts, apparently, to get an energy ceasefire in Ukraine. That hasn't happened. They can all see that things are not going well in Ukraine, even though they want to pretend otherwise. And I think the strike with the Oreshnik probably did a great deal of damage, which, of course, we're not being told about. So one way or another, and with the Americans looking increasingly disengaged from this, not because they feel warm towards the Russians, which I was trying to assassinate Putin a few weeks ago. It's because everything has been tried and everything has failed. And the Americans don't want to be tied down in something that is increasingly looking like a failure. And so they're starting to go and look, take on other things. I think the Europeans are beginning to say to themselves, well, where are we? What can we do? We're in a terrible mess. Our political position is collapsing. Starmer's position in London is collapsing. Macron is he's an exhausted volcano, if I can put it like that. He's not going to be president in a year. And BlackRock Mertz, his economy is falling apart. Everything is going wrong. There's grumbling from the Mittelstand. The AfD is breathing on his back. So he says, well, maybe after all, it's time to start rethinking and changing views and all of those things. The big giveaway was Zelensky's speech at Davos. And he was so so angry with the Europeans, calling them weak and useless. That really told you that things are not going well in either in Ukraine itself or between Zelensky and Europe. I mean, he's never spoken about his dear European friends and allies in that way at any point in the war up to now.
People from Ontario, Calgary, Australia, Italy, Zurich, Toronto, Perth, Ireland, all joining us on this live stream. Big shout out to everyone that is watching us from all over the world. Hello from Singapore. Good to have you with us. Everyone from Singapore and from Holland and from Serbia and from Thessaloniki and Melbourne is in the house. And New Zealand is with us. And Norway, Alexander, Carney and Callis. Carney and Callis have announced the end of the rules-based order. Isn't that something, huh? Carney at Davos and Callis yesterday, they have officially announced the end of the international rules-based order, and they are talking about a new system being ushered in. What are your thoughts there?
Yes,
and
I know.
To some questions.
I mean, coming from someone like Callis, it really is a sign of desperation. I mean, I'm not going to say it's the raising of the white flag exactly, because that's, she doesn't think in those terms. I mean, whether she thinks at all is a good question. But anyway, Carney's speech, to be honest, when I read it, I haven't heard him speaking it because I'm sure it would make me even more angry. But when I read it, the smoke was coming out of my ears. I mean, basically, he was telling you, you're telling us all, look, we were telling you all about this great rules-based international order. It never really existed. It was all a fraud. It was all a fraud out of which we made lots and lots of money. We did really well out of it. Now we've been rumbled. It's all falling apart. So the time has come to come up with a new fraud. I mean, that's basically what his speech said. And everybody applauds it and said, oh, it's wonderful. He's now admitted that he and others were participating in a gigantic fraud. So, I mean, the cynicism of it left me absolutely speechless. But, you know, they're talking about a new order. The very fact that they're talking about a new order at all, whatever that is, should ring alarm bells, because I can absolutely guarantee that the new order will be the same as the old order. It will be the same people in charge, running the same things in exactly the same way, telling us the same fairy tales as always, only they won't call it a rules-based order. They'll be calling it some other type of order. But anyway, that's what they are trying and planning to do. But the fact that they've been rumbled, the fact that they understand that this thing is falling apart around them, in itself, I suppose, is interesting. And in a kind of way, I suppose we should even be grateful.
Something's going on, Alexander. Something's going on. Gold, silver, the dollar, Carney in China, Stammer in China, Mertz saying no to Ukraine, fast-tracked in the EU. They're up to something. I can't figure out what it is, what this new order is going to be, or how they're structuring it. Maybe they don't even know. But they're up to something.
Yes, I know, absolutely. I mean, this isn't. I was going to say. I mean, nobody should expect anything good from these people. I mean, that is, or any real sense of realism from these people either. They have failed in Ukraine. That is an enormous blow to them. I mean, that really shakes the whole system. They're very worried about what the BRICS are doing and the digital currencies and all of that. They're very worried about the United States and the direction it is going, the fact that it is basically becoming unmoored, some would say unhinged. I mean, striking out in all directions, becoming increasingly aggressive and increasingly violent. So there are these factors at play, which is driving them to take these steps. But at the same time, their priorities remain the same as always. They are in control. We are not. That's basically what that's about. So what exactly they're going to come up with, whether they're going to try and enlist the Chinese and the Indians and the Russians to buttress
that's
the new
what
system.
I was thinking.
Yeah, I mean, that yeah, may
I'm
be what
thinking
it,
the globalists, all of these people are saying, you know, let's shift a little bit towards China and BRICS now. Is that possible?
Well, nothing is impossible. I sense probably not. I said previously the Chinese don't like Keir Starmer, so he's a terrible messenger to send to China. The Chinese have been writing absolutely excoriating commentaries about the situation in Europe and about the quality of governance there. I get the sense that in Russia, there may still be a couple of Europeanists and a couple of business people, and Putin might still have, you know, tugs that pull him bit back towards Europe. But again, I think the mood has shifted. I think probably in China, Russia, probably India too, they say to themselves, well, why should we attach ourselves to a sinking part of the world when our part of the world is rising? And I think they probably won't want to come to the rescue. But then the temptations of power and control are very strong. Human nature being what it is, I can't completely say that the Russians, the Chinese won't play along in some way or in some form. I don't think they will, but you know, maintaining a degree of cynicism is never a bad thing.
Right. Two more questions before we get to everyone's questions. Rubio in the Senate, he is saying that Witkoff and Kushner are not going to be present during the next round of talks, which is going to happen, I believe, this Sunday, the 1st of February, I believe, we're going to have the second round, but the third talks between Russia and Ukraine. The United States may send representatives. but Kushner, Witkoff are not going to be there. And Rubio presented it as more of a bilateral meeting between Ukraine and Russia. He also painted the picture of the negotiations pretty much hinging on one point. One point is left, and that is the territory. Everything else has pretty much been resolved.
Yeah.
What did you make of Rubio's comments?
Well, very interesting comments, but let us just unpack them and take them through. First of all, Witkoff and Kushner not going. We predicted it. We said that this was, from the Russian point of view, a technical discussion. It was discussed as security issues, things like the attack on Valdai, things of that kind. They were not going to discuss political questions. They were going to discuss security and military issues. And I suspect the person who's going to run the negotiations on the American side is going to be Driscoll. I always said to myself, this is the real American delegation, Driscoll and Grinkevich, who are, by the way, on opposite sides, just to say, but they're from the Pentagon. Driscoll, because the civilians in the Pentagon want to close down the Ukraine war. Grinkevich, because the generals don't. So that's what the Americans are there to do. There is no real negotiation going on in Abu Dhabi. I think this is a misunderstanding. It's a working party. But this is not a political, these are not political talks. There's nobody sitting down and talking about negotiations. I don't know what Rubio says, it's all about territory. It's what the Americans are continuously saying. The Russians say quite different things. They say that all of these other issues have to be addressed and discussed as well. And when Rubio was specifically asked, have the Russians agreed to the security guarantees that people have been talking about over Ukraine? The answer was no, they haven't. And the security guarantees, from a Russian perspective, are as serious a topic as territory. In fact, more serious, because the Russians, Putin, have repeatedly said NATO is an absolute central aspect to this. Article 5 issues as a central aspect of this. Rubio was still floating the idea of European troops in Ukraine. The Russians said in Abu Dhabi, that is absolutely unacceptable. We will not agree to that at all, not under any circumstances. So the Americans are trying to reduce it to a question of territory. The Russians are not. And the big takeaway from that is that there's no negotiations. There's no real movement towards negotiations. We are as far away from an agreement as ever.
All right. Final question, and then we get to everyone's questions in the chat. Al-Jalani in Moscow. Al-Shara in Moscow. What do you make of that?
Lots of people in Russia are very, very unhappy about this. No doubt about this. I mean, it's many of them are very, very shocked. Many of them are saying, well, what was all that about then? You know, our intervention in Syria, if we're now going to make up with someone like that. Putin, nonetheless, continues with this. In some ways, it's Russian. It's saying, you know, he's the man in charge. We must deal with him. And we must get the best that we can out of this situation. So we keep our bases in eastern Ukraine. We bring Syria, to the extent that we can, under a central government. And we get
in eastern Syria, you mean? You
said eastern Syria, absolutely, yeah, absolutely. Sorry. I mean notice that he basically backed what Jalani's been doing with the Kurds. And because the Kurds, who had an excellent relationship with the Russians, destroyed it. We must discuss the Kurds at some point in a perhaps dedicated program, because they played the whole Syrian war disastrously wrong. I mean, they should have done work to do deals with Assad. They could have used the Russians as intermediaries. They instead stuck with this alliance with the Americans. The Americans are throwing them under a bus, and the Russians are happy. And the Russians are also working with Jalani to get the Americans out of Syria, which has been a Russian objective. So it is very cynical. It is pure realpolitik. It looks very, very ugly. You can see why the Russians are doing it. But I have to ask myself, really, the optics are so bad. Is it worth it? I mean, what are Russia's real interests in Syria now? All right, let's say you succeed, you get Syria reunited, you have someone like Jalani in charge. Is this really a Syria you want to work with going forward? Is this really your objective? Anyway, there it is.
Realpolitik. Yeah.
In its most cynical form, in its ugliest, most cynical form.
I wonder how long Al Jalani is going to survive as president.
Not very.
Unelected president of Syria. The guy seems toxic. Everywhere he goes, yeah. It's just bad. It's really just bad optics. Whether he's in the White House or whether he's in the Kremlin, it just looks awful. I wonder how long he's going to last.
He's not going to last very long. Everybody's using him to pursue their own objectives. He looks totally dispensable. Whether he knows that, I have no idea. But I doubt that he'll be there very long.
All right. Let's.
By the way, no coverage in the media here in London of the fact that Jalani is in Moscow. This is too upsetting and embarrassing a reality to admit to.
Hey, what's going on with the general in China? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think he was taking bribes. But I'll tell you what I think about this. The Chinese military has, over the last 10 years, expanded enormously in size and capabilities. And that has been managed by a group of military officers who have been trained and brought up in a military completely different from the one that we see now. So what this is going to do inevitably is it's going to create stresses between the political leadership and the military, because the political leadership is going to be very worried that these generals who are there, who've seen the military expand so much, might have their own political ideas. In China, the military has always played a role in politics, at least since the Mao era. So they're going to be concerned about this. So they're going to be concerned about loyalty. And it's likely that some members of the Chinese military, in particular this particular general, probably have taken advantage of this enormous growth in the military in China to feather their own nests. Tensions between the politicians, the political leadership, and the military in this situation are not actually entirely surprising. I'll give you a famous example, and that is the Soviet Union in the 1930s. Then, the Soviets massively expanded the size of their military over the course of the 1930s. It went from being basically a militia at the start of the 1930s to being a huge mechanized force. This made the political leadership, Stalin and his officials, very suspicious of what the military were all about, because they'd suddenly achieved this enormous power. They were also worried about not just corruption, but, you know, the way that corruption was operating within the military as well. And the tensions became so great that it exploded in the terror of 1937. So this is not, I mean, I'm not saying that this is going to be on anything like that kind of scale, but this sort of thing is not perhaps completely surprising, given the developments in the military that we've seen in China over the last 10 years.
All right, let's hit that like button, and let's get the views to 4,000 on YouTube. We're almost there, so let's smash that like button. I like it a lot. I like it a lot. And to Nick, who's getting ready for work in the U.S., have a good day at work, Nick. Thanks for joining us. And let's get to the questions, Alexander. 26% off all merch on the Durant Shop, by the way. You can find the link to the Durant Shop in the description box down below. And we start off with Nikos, who says, I feel disgusted by all sides this previous week, from the worst Davos summit to Trump, to Zelensky, to people like Helmer demanding nuclear war. Trump's speech was like Stalin's Soviet Politburo in the 50s, just pure terror. And no one had the courage to call him out as he was handed Greenland. I think, okay, yeah, two-part question. All right, that's the question. Alexander.
Well, yeah, I mean, I would add that apparently Trump returned to the United States in an absolutely foul mood. He didn't enjoy himself in Davos either. So I get the sense that nobody went to Davos and came out of it happy. At least none of the top leaders did. So, I agree. I mean, you know, we are looking at a very angry, very cynical, a very cynical time. And one can get angry about it, but we should not let our anger prevent us from trying to understand these events and looking and trying to understand why they're happening as they are and their causes. I mean, that's what we must do. Anger can blind you when, as I said, what you need to do is to approach these things analytically and see where we're going. And I think that we are seeing stresses in the Western system that we haven't seen before. I've never known relations between the Europeans and the Americans to be so bad. I know some people think this is faked. I can tell you for an absolute fact, it is not faked. It is real. I'm not saying that anybody has any plan how to deal with it. But ultimately, this is unsurprising when all of these parties, the Americans, the Europeans, have invested so much political, military and financial capital in a project Ukraine that has turned out so disastrously and catastrophically wrong. And I think deep down, the underlying core explanation of everything that we saw in Davos and everything else that we are seeing is that.
Yeah, I think that that the globalists are finally starting to accept the fact that we're moving into a multipolar world.
Yeah,
it's inevitable. And I still haven't been able to put all the pieces together, but yeah, they're positioning themselves to benefit and to even rule in the multipolar world, most likely to rule in the multipolar world.
Absolutely, these globalist leaders.
We're seeing the Carneys in China, the Stammers in China. Yeah. That's why we're seeing the gold, the silver, the USD, Iran, all of these things that are happening. The Al-Jalanis in DC and in Moscow, they're positioning themselves to benefit from all of this.
Exactly, that is exactly right.
Let's take a comment from Matthew. What a joke BRICS is, can't even defend Iran.
Well, if Iran won't ask for help from BRICS, what are the other countries supposed to do? Now, at this moment in time, we don't know what is going on between Iran and the United States. We don't know how this is going to play out. But let me remind you again, I mean, you know, we've had many crises around the world. In Vietnam, did China and the Soviet Union come to defend Vietnam? No. Vietnam defended itself. Then they were able to help it. It's the same with Iran. Ultimately, it is Iran itself that must defend itself. It's a big country. It is, in some ways, a very developed country, contrary to what many people think. The population is educated. It's got a large amount of industry. It's got good engineers. If it can't sort out its own problems and make the obvious decisions it needs to make in order to get help when it's offered, then what are other outsiders supposed to do? I've discussed this, we've discussed this many, many times. It's up to Iran at the end of the day.
Matthew also asks, how do you see the situation in Iran evolving?
Well, there's going to be an attack. I don't know what the form of that attack is going to be. I don't know how sustained this is going to be. The word from Iran at the moment is that even if there is a small attack, the Iranians are now reached that point where they've decided that It makes no sense for them to pull punches anymore. If there is any kind of attack at all, they will respond powerfully with all that they've got, because the last thing Iran wants is an endless war fought by the Americans, with the Americans setting the timing of when they attack and when they don't, and the Americans strangling Iran through sanctions and doing all of those kind of things. So the Iranians now are talking about responding to any American attack by striking at bases, trying to hunt the US Navy carrier, closing the Straits of Hormuz, all of those things. Ultimately, it all depends on one thing: the stability of the government in Tehran. In June, when the Israelis attacked, they expected the government to collapse. It didn't. In January, at the beginning of January, with the protests, they expected the government to collapse. It didn't. Now we're going to get an even bigger strike. If the government survives, it can retain control and hold things together and start to make decisions which will increase the pressure long term on the US and Israel. Well, gradually over time, the balance will tilt in its favor, because the United States is not ready for a long war.
All right, Nico says, then we had Zelensky at his vilest, insulting Europe and demanding more of our money and to start World War III. Who the hell are you, you delusional dictator? Mm-hmm. Part two is, we are suffering in our countries as I see recruitment ads in Greece to fight a war for a guy who took our money and gets a standing ovation for it.
Well, I agree with every point you've made, Nikos. I mean, this is one occasion when, as I said, I'm not really, I mean, there's nothing you've said, but in both parts of your question that I disagree with. I mean, I share your anger and your disgust and your contempt, but ultimately, I come back to what I said. We must take a step back and think through why what is happening is happening, because that's ultimately the way that we keep ourselves. If we can look for ways forward and understand why the world is turning out the way it is, which is important for us as individuals as well.
Jungle Jin says, Cuba may be Russia's ally, but if the U.S. attacks Cuba, does this actually mean anything? What could Russia meaningfully do? It won't fight the U.S. Yeah, well, Trump said that Cuba's going down. That's pretty much what Trump said.
Yeah, I know. For the moment, the United States is not talking about a full frontal assault on Cuba. And I'll tell you why. Not because of the Russians. Back during the Cold War, there was a reason why the United States didn't invade Cuba, because the Soviets made it clear that if that happened, they would occupy West Berlin. So, I mean, that was actually part of the Cuban Missile Crisis. It was part of the discussions that took place at that time. Well, obviously, the Russians don't have that kind of leverage today. So the Russians won't. It's not that the Americans are afraid of the Russians going to war over Cuba. It is that an attack on Cuba is going to be very, very unpopular with many people on the left in the United States and in Europe. There is enormous sentimental feelings about Cuba, which I partially understand. I don't fully understand, but I partially do. They feel very sentimental about it. You know, all the students with their Che Guevara posters, some of whom are now ministers. So the US, the government, the Trump administration knows that if they do attack Cuba, there will be a backlash. And for that reason, I think that is a certain restraint on them. There's probably some calculation also that the Cuban military is better organized, more disciplined, and more likely to hold together and fight back than the Venezuelan military was. So at the moment, the plan is to strangle Cuba economically, to deprive it of oil. And yes, that is possible. Now, this is where the Russians come in, because the Russians have lots of oil. They have an enormous abundance of oil. They can supply Cuba with oil. They can send tankers, Russian tankers, to Cuba with oil. They can provide naval escorts for those tankers. I don't think the United States would want to tangle with them. But Cuba must ask for them. Even now, even after the fall of Maduro, they haven't done that. I mean, I was expecting the Cuban president, Cuban officials, to be calling Moscow, asking for help. The Russians have said that we are allies. That is an offer of help, if you think about it. If you call a country your ally, it says, look, we're there. We're ready to help you. The Cubans so far still are not doing it. And again, the big puzzle is why.
Nico says, most recently, I saw old people like Helmer Jatras, Paul Craig Roberts, calling Russia a paper tiger and urging them to strike the West. Excuse me, Mr. Helmer, but who is going to fight World War III that you encourage? Who will have to survive a nuclear holocaust? You who have lived your life? No, it will be me and others my age who are left with cleaning up the mess. Your arrogant generation. We locked ourselves for 2 years over a flu for you.
Again, I can't say I disagree with any of these points.
All right. Matt Powell, welcome to Drand Community. Derek Dominoes, what are your thoughts on the Japan bond market sell-off and the global ramifications? Good question. It's
very, very good question. I'm not a market analyst. I'm not a financial analyst. I get the sense that things are not good in Japan. I mean, Japan basically has been in a state of economic stagnation of one sort or another since the late 1980s. And one gets the sense that things are very overextended there. There's also a demographic crisis, which is one of the worst you will find anywhere. I mean, the Japanese birth rate collapsed before the birth rate collapsed pretty much anywhere else. So, I mean, their population is becoming very lopsided now, with all of this debt having accumulated. I don't know enough about Japan to understand the direct problems here, why this has happened now. But Japan is big. It's a very important economy. It's a very important American ally in East Asia. It's very, very much part of the global financial system. Long ago, when I was working in London, not in the city of London, but close to the city of London, and had connections with the financial world, at that time, we used to say that the three big stock markets were New York, London, and Tokyo. Just to say, I don't think that's true any longer. But anything, a crash of Japanese bonds, a real crisis there, is going to have huge effects around the world. It will be like the Asian financial crisis of 1998, only very, very much bigger.
Mm-hmm. Nico says, the CIA infiltrated China's highest-ranking generals, who at best gave nuclear secrets, at worst were planning a coup, bribes. That's what the U.S. does. That's what they've done in Russia. The FSB has foiled countless operations by bribed civilians. They are not incompetent. The operations are so many.
Oh, well, who's not incompetent? The FSB or the CIA? I don't think either is incompetent.
I guess both.
I don't think either of them are incompetent. About the Chinese general giving nuclear secrets to the United States, that came from a piece in the Wall Street Journal. And I have to say, I think it's a bit unlikely, but for one very obvious reason, which is that I get the sense that the United States isn't terribly well informed and doesn't very well understand the extent of the Chinese nuclear buildup. It looked to me, and you know, I'm guessing now, but it looked to me more an attempt by someone in the intelligence community to stir this situation in Beijing up and to make it even bigger than it already is. So and to feed suspicions in Beijing that, you know, there is actual a crisis of loyalty within the Chinese military, as well as corruption and those sort of things. It's certainly an intriguing story, and we need to keep track on it. I will add one other thing, which is that Xi Jinping himself not only has made it a big issue to stamp out corruption within the Chinese government and the party, but he apparently personally loathes corruption. He leads a very ascetic lifestyle, and so do the other members of his family. And he demands that other Chinese leaders do the same. And he not only demands it, but he takes extraordinarily tough action whenever he discovers that there has been corruption or bribery of any kind. So in a sense, he's acting in character here. And I've heard Western people from China, people like Kerry Brown, who we had briefly on a program, telling me this. So in a kind of sense, it doesn't surprise me.
From locals, Dionysia says, I was dismayed to see on Lotus Eater's poll this morning that a majority are in favor of U.S. intervention in Iran. That is a poll from Politico that came out. And Jabberwocky said, do you think that the Iran strike will be delayed while Trump waits for the CIA to attempt some kind of operation within Iran?
I think the CIA already attempted an operation in Iran and it failed. And that was the one that we saw in January. So I don't think so. I think that they're going to move towards some kind of a military operation fairly quickly. I'm not going to try and guess what it was. I think the kind of decapitation strike that was attempted in June is going to be more difficult this time. But I still think that the objective is to eliminate the Iranian leadership in whatever way they can. I mean, I can't see how else regime change in Iran is possible. So I think that is the objective. And that's, I think, how it's going to play out. As for whether or not this has popular support in the United States, well, this is where all of the rhetoric about the protests in Iran and the tens of thousands of people who were killed and all of that, that's where that comes. Again, my experience of that sort of thing is you get a brief burst of approval, and then it very quickly fades. So I wouldn't put too much weight on this.
Well, the poll, just a correction, the poll was for Trump voters. Trump voters are 60% in favor of some sort of a strike. I believe that's what the poll said. So it just sampled the Trump voting base. So
What I would say about that then is that 60% is far from overwhelming support.
Yeah,
I would be worried if I was Trump. I'd be worried about that poll. It seems to me that if things go wrong, then he's in serious trouble.
Yeah. Well, if the strike happens, it usually happens on a weekend, usually on a Friday or a Saturday.
Exactly.
We'll see.
Exactly.
Hello there, says, hello, gents. Is there a historical relationship between Russia and the Eastern Roman Empire? Does Russia see itself as a civilization state today?
Yes, it does. And there was a very strong connection between Russia and the Eastern Roman Empire. The Orthodoxy came to Russia from Byzantium. Grand Prince of Kiev, which was, of course, Kievan Rus, it encompassed all of Russia. There was no distinction between Russia and Ukraine at that time. Anyway, he was baptized in Kherson, which is at that time, the original city of Kherson was in Crimea, close to Sevastopol, and it was a Byzantine city. The emperor was there. The British Byzantine Empire controlled it. So that was where he was baptized by the emperor's representatives, the priests from Constantinople. And the emperor built the first church in Kievan Rus, which stands to this day, which is St. Sophia's Cathedral in Kiev, which is the oldest church in Russian Orthodoxy. So there is a very, very long connection. And Russians, they were called Varangians because many of them, had Scandinavian backgrounds, but many of them were Russians. For a time, formed the emperor's personal bodyguard in Constantinople, the so-called Varangian Guard. So you see that the connections go back very, very far and very, very long. And then at the end, at the time of the fall, the final fall of the Byzantine Empire, Sophia Palaiologos, who was a member of the royal family, the imperial family of Constantinople, she married the Grand Prince of Moscow, who was already beginning to refer to himself as Tsar, and the grandson of that union was the ruler whom the Russians called Ivan Grozny, whose name is being mischaracterized as Ivan the Terrible. So exactly. So I mean, so the connections are extremely strong. And by the way, just to finish on this, in the 17th century, the Russians discovered that the way they conducted the worship in their churches had started to deviate from Greek Orthodox models. And so the Tsar at that time, a man called Alexei, and the Patriarch, a man called Nikon, decided that this was wrong and that they needed to go back closer to the way in which Orthodoxy was being practiced, in fact, to put it back in alignment with Constantinople. And that was a major reform of Russian Orthodoxy that took place in the 17th century. And some Russian Orthodox Christians were very unhappy about these changes, and that created a schism. And you have to this day in Russia, the old believers who still practice Orthodoxy before that change. But you can see that the connections are very, very strong.
And you can see the differences between the Russian Orthodox Church and the Greek Orthodox Church.
You can.
Small absolutely. Differences, but they're there in the worship as well. Yeah,
exactly.
Westwolf Esquire says, the U.S. is threatening a naval blockade of Cuba, essentially an oil embargo. Russia has the option of sending an oil relief convoy under naval escort.
Yes, if the Cubans ask, which they haven't. I mean, they've done nothing. Again, I mean, I find this very strange that, you know, the Iranians don't ask for help. The Cubans don't ask for help. I don't know why these people are so unwilling to do this. When Putin calls them allies, when his spokesman Peskov says that Russia is very alarmed by talk about a U.S. naval blockade and that they are trying to find out what this is, whether this is really going to happen, that they're going to push back on this. Why do the Cubans sit around doing nothing? Why do they go to Mexico, of all places, and try to get their oil from there?
Maybe there are people in the government of these countries who are told not to ask for help.
Well, I think you've almost certainly put your finger on it. In Cuba, I'm afraid that is true.
Yeah. Sanjeva says, persons are angry at Trump for meeting al-Jalani and compromising on Ukraine. But thing is, Putin has to hold together and securing a vast country. Southern flank is now at risk with IS jihadi resurgence in Syria. That, in part two, is that could spill over to control Asian countries, risking the southern flank of Russia. Western flank beyond Ukraine needs securing. Economy and quality of life of Russians needs to be considered too.
You're absolutely right. I mean, that is the thinking. I mean, you've described the thinking very well. And it's the same thinking that the Russians have adopted about Afghanistan. I mean, the Russians had long-standing connections with the Taliban, by the way. And they've since become, with China, backers, in effect, of the Taliban, mostly because they want the Taliban to fight ISIS-K, which has bases in Afghanistan, and to prevent it from getting a foothold there. And I think the same is true with Jalani. They're saying to themselves, well, you know, we've had our history with Jalani, but, you know, let's give his whatever support we can. Let's get the Americans out. Let's bring the Kurdish regions back under control. And let's use Jalani to try to prevent ISIS from reestablishing itself in Syria. One can understand the motivations and the thinking. With Jalani, I do wonder ultimately, though.
He is ISIS.
Exactly, whether it's going to work. I mean, he was himself an ISIS official for a long time. He was very, very close to al-Baghdadi. Remember, al-Baghdadi was hiding in Idlib province. Who was running Idlib province at that time? Adel Jalani. That's where the Americans got him. So, you know,
Russians know all of this.
I know, exactly. I mean, I'm not convinced that this is really going to work. But anyway, that's... And besides, do you really want to lavish praise on Jalani in the way that Putin did yesterday? Just so...
Bill Grinder, thank you for that super chat. Jim Wood says, based on recent developments, what would you think Russia's plans regarding Sumy and Chernihiv at the north will be? Greetings from Southeast England, Epsom. Hello to Southeast England.
Indeed, absolutely. Alexander. Yeah. That's an excellent question, actually. It's a very, very good question. I don't think anybody really has the answer, because the Russians, over the last few weeks, months, have been... Ever since, you know, Volchansk fell, but I mean, they've been making all these sorts of sporadic moves in Kharkiv, the Sumy region. They take a village here, they take a village there. They then cross the border and take another village well away from where the main forces are concentrated. It doesn't seem as if there's many Ukrainian forces there at the moment. It doesn't seem as if the Russian forces are huge there either. And, you know, what ultimately is this all about? It's said that this is a buffer zone, but in what respect is this actually a buffer zone precisely? None of this makes sense. My guess is this. It probably serves two purposes. One is to tie down at least some Ukrainian troops in northeastern Ukraine. So as the Russians complete their business in Donbass and Zaporozhye, where they're coming closer and closer to doing so. And then the next thing is, and this is my guess now, I mean, I really don't know, but this is that the Russians are creating a launch pad for a future big operation towards Kiev. I'm not saying that this is absolutely their immediate plan or that it's going to even happen this year, but I think that this is what it looks like to me. All of these places where the Russians are taking up positions seem to me to make sense if that is the ultimate objective.
Fitzo's November 2027 timeline for the war to end. Do you think that's accurate?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, this year, they will finish Zaporozhye and Donbass. That's what I think they're going to do. And then, being the Russians, they will give an ultimatum. I mean, it won't be couched as an ultimatum, but it will be a kind of ultimatum. They'll say to Zelensky and to the West, look, we now control the four regions. This is the moment where you either agree to every other part of Istanbul plus, or we will take whatever measures we consider appropriate in order to ensure that every part of Istanbul Plus is fulfilled. Zelensky will reject it because he will, or whoever replaces him, whoever is in charge in Kiev will reject it. And at that point, we will see the big armies activated and they will be pushed towards Kiev. And that will be the campaign in 2027, and it will end the war.
I believe Rubio said during his testimony to the Senate that the security guarantees will incorporate mostly French troops into Ukraine. I think that's what he said. 2027, do you think that that Europe, the French troops, enter Ukraine then? All of this happens with Zaporozhye.
Well, this is a very good question.
I don't know. Maybe the chat can correct me, but I do believe that Rubio did say that, or something along those lines about the U.S. is not going to provide these big security guarantees that Zelensky wants, but France is going to be providing most of the security guarantees or troops in Ukraine if there is some sort of a deal or ceasefire.
Bear in mind that in 2027, in spring 2027, Macron ceases to be president of France. I know of no other political figure of any stature in France who supports this. And I understand that it is also unpopular with the French military. So by that point, its primary advocate in France will be either on his way out or will be out. And I cannot imagine that anybody's going to go into the French elections, the presidential elections, appearing to advocate or support or give any sense that he's supporting that sort of thing. So I suspect that in 2027, it's going to melt away.
West Wolf Esquire says, A&A, if Trump does indeed attack Iran while a U.S. state is openly refusing federal authority and the governor effectively calling for a war on security agents of the U.S. federal government, what message does this send?
Well, it sends a terrible message. And I this is where I think that Trump himself is going wrong. I mean, he ought to be focusing far more on the situation in the United States. He's lost, by the way, control of the narrative about Minnesota, about the events there. Can I just, I mean, that sounds cynical, but I mean, you have to be out messaging, you have to control what everybody's saying in your administration when you're facing this kind of crisis. You talk about federal authority, you talk about all of those things, and you do it with much more careful language than has been used up to now. And you make sure that the person who is in charge, the people who are in charge, know their job and they're disciplined, that they are doing it properly. Instead of which, the president, thinking all the time about other things, Greenland, Iran, Russia, talking about all of these other matters, even though the situation in the United States is slipping out of his control. It's a terrible message. It makes me wonder, actually, whether the United States is becoming ungovernable as well.
Geostone says, do you agree that Iran needs multiple nuclear weapons? Israel and the U.S. want complete missile disarmament, and it won't stop until Iran is a Syria model.
Well, I find the idea of the collapse of nuclear non-proliferation utterly abhorrent. The idea appalls me. But if you're talking about Iran, putting aside my own feelings, which, as I said, are repelled completely by this idea, Iranian officials, including many of the same officials who were killed in the Israeli strikes in June, were going around basically to the Iranian media, and they were saying, not openly, but it didn't take much interpretation, what on earth are we doing? Why do we continue with this nuclear enrichment program if we're not going to take it to its logical conclusion and acquiring nuclear weapon? What is Khamenei up to? All he's doing by approaching it in this way is he's provoking the Americans and making enormous problems for us, where whilst he's not actually providing us with the benefit of nuclear enrichment, which is the weapons that ultimately come from it. And if there's some strange idea of using a nuclear enrichment program as a means to obtain leverage over the Americans, that is absurd, because all it is doing is it's going to provoke rather than deter. Now, I remember reading all of this. I was reading all of this from the autumn of 2024. There was a particular cluster of comments from Iranian officials making those very same points, which you could read on in the Iranian media from the autumn of 2024. And then, of course, Khamenei came along and said, under no circumstances are we going to move forward with this. And Pezeshkian also, of course, he was elected, and he also said, under no circumstances. And at the same time, they won't give up their nuclear enrichment program. So I say this too, the Iranian policy has never made any sense to me. It made no sense to me at all. Why you are continuing to pursue nuclear enrichment, why you are going beyond the 3.25 level of nuclear enrichment all the way up to 60%, but you're not going to go any further if you really do not intend to acquire a nuclear weapon. It was shot through with contradictions, and I think it played a role in bringing us to the very situation that we're in today.
Paul Walker says, thoughts on two Scots taken in Scotland by the USA. I don't know this story, do you?
No, I don't know very much about it because the British media is barely reporting it. Disturbing, and I'm going to try and find out about it.
Lots of
bad things happening like that now.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Dark Horse says, seems like German psychology never fully recovered to a healthy state since World War One. Carl Jung covered the psych that made World War II. Did anyone analyze the mass psychology of modern Germany?
I have no idea. I mean, I'm not somebody who follows that sort of thing, but I have absolutely no idea. It would be an interesting topic of study. I agree, by the way.
Mm. Spaso Jager says, greetings for all. Great day here, True News. Thank you for that.
Thanks.
Sticky Mark says, define insanity when you continue to do the same thing repeatedly, expecting different results, LNPs, etc., from this crazy old in Yorkshire. Thanks. Thank you, Sticky Mark, for that.
I mean, the word I tend to use is, I mean, I do sometimes use the word insanity, but irrational. I mean, decisions that seem to me so contrary to any kind of interest or beneficial outcome. And I always have real problems understanding why people do that. The latest example being this absolutely bizarre decision the European Union has made, which is to ban indefinitely and forever and by law, tearing up their own rule book, imports of Russian gas. I mean, tearing up the rule book for the many reasons we said, given that the fact that the European Union is itself a creation of that very same rule book, seems to me a bizarre thing to do. But doing this also in the middle of an energy crisis, increasing your dependence on the United States, that seems to me irrational. And yet that is what the leaders of Europe have just done, including Friedrich Merz.
Yeah. Mole6923 says, hi, Alex and Alexander. Can Putin finally stop playing chicken and be serious about USA and Trump? And is there other Russian offensive? How will it look?
Well, I think I said so. I mean, there was a good piece by a Russian military analyst called Sergei Politaev, who's discussed what the Russians are probably likely going to do in 2026, and it's not difficult. They're going to encircle and capture the two big fortified cities in Donbass, Slavyansk, Kramatorsk. They're clearly the big objective. And it looks like they're going to wrap up Zaporozhye and perhaps take Zaporozhye as well. That seems to be their major priority for 2026. What they're going to do in 2027, well, we've talked about that already in this program.
Yeah, Zaporozhye is going to be a big defeat.
It's huge. And if Zaporozhye city falls at that point, by the way, the entire Western narrative of the Russians making no progress, it's stalemate and all of that. I read in the Daily Telegraph today that the Ukrainians still control Chasiv Yar, by the way. all of these things, all of these stories finally will collapse. It will be impossible any longer to sustain them. I don't think Putin is playing chicken. I think that this is a major mistake. To repeat again, what concessions to the Americans did he actually make over the course of 2025? The answer is none.
None.
None at all.
None. Yeah. The concession to meet and talk.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And to host Witkoff eight times, in the middle of the night, and give
Witkoff an enormous amount of Putin's valuable time.
True.
Which it has raised eyebrows and does come in for a lot of criticism in Russia. But yeah, if you're talking about actual concessions, he's not made any.
Yeah, Lana, thank you for that. Matthew says, will Israel resort to nuclear weapons?
Well, they've said on many occasions, I mean, they haven't admitted, of course, that they have nuclear weapons, but they've said that if they feel that they're in existential crisis, then all options are on the table. And they said that specifically with respect to Iran as well, by the way. And so if there is a situation where the war begins to go badly wrong and the Iranians are pounding Israel with their missiles, then, well, I'd say all bets are off. And we have to be prepared for this. We have to think this through. I don't know whether Donald Trump has, but the risks here are very high.
Yeah. West Wolf says, if you gents are familiar with Rachel Blevins, she was interviewing Glenn Deason this week and asked him about Istanbul Plus. I think the term has stuck.
Oh, yeah.
That was absolutely Alexander's term, as was deindustrialization.
We never
escalation.
Alex has won the Alensky curse, which I have seen in the mainstream media in London. I mean, all of these things, of course, hell will freeze over before they'd ever admit where all of these expressions came from. But there we go.
Yeah, unfortunately. Anyway, all right. Thank you for that, Wes Wolf. Fiona Whelan says, gentlemen, please consider to invite Martin Armstrong. His insight will be very on time. Keep up the great work. Yeah, Martin's putting out some really cool tweets, ex posts, especially on the dollar and all of that stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah. We've actually had him once, I think. Yeah.
Nico says, more and more Russians demand the use of nuclear weapons. Levon is fully subscribed to it. People on socials want it, and even officials call for it. One sec, let me get part two. Maybe they are right. The West will seize ships and blockade Russia despite Russia sending protection. The UK is deploying nuclear weapons in Sweden. I don't think Levon is subscribed to the nuclear. I just think he's raising the alarm bells about the use of nuclear weapons. I mean, I've met Levon many, many times. I can tell you he's very much against any use of nuclear weapons. I just want to say that. Anyway, Alexander.
Yes. I have to say straight away that I've not seen a single comment by any official, any Russian official, that even remotely hints at that sort of thing. For the moment, I don't think this is part of the agenda at all. And I don't think the Russians feel that they have the need to make those threats about nuclear weapons. To say it straightforwardly, I mean, if we go back to the Marinera episode, which I know I've spent an inordinate amount talking about, the United States has just released the two Russian sailors. They've gone back to Russia. I think that when it comes down to it, in the end, the United States does not want to take the Russians on in a public fashion. What goes on covertly, what the CIA does secretly with drones attacking Valdai, that's one thing. But if it comes to a direct open clash with the Russian military, the Americans do everything they possibly can to avoid getting themselves into a situation. And you saw that with Rubio. He says, you know, the Americans are not going to go into Ukraine. It's going to be left to the French. They're going to take care of it. We are just going to provide the backstop. And, you know, he doesn't even give clear answers to what that backstop even is. And when he's asked, have the Russians agreed? He had to admit, no, they haven't. So there it is. I mean, you know, the Americans understand that the Russian military is different and they don't want to take it on head on. And I think that's going to stick.
Yeah. One thing that we know about the Trump foreign policy, at least for the first year, is that Trump looks for knockout rounds, knockout punches. Yes. He's not looking to go 10 rounds. He wants to avoid boots on the ground. I'm not saying that's going to be the case with Iran or anything like that. Maybe you do get boots on the ground in a future conflict that Trump commits to. But so far in the first year, the Trump foreign policy, at least with regards to regime changes and all these wars and conflicts, is to use these covert operations, the bribes, the trickery, the misdirection, and to do stuff like what happened in Venezuela, or to try and decapitate the leadership in Iran. And you saw after 12 days, Trump tapped out.
Exactly.
He's looking for that knockout punch in the first or second round. At least that's the trend for the first year. I'm not saying it's going to hold going forward.
It's exactly the same with the Houthis. The same with the Houthis.
Yeah, you're right about that. Yeah. Zariel says that Mertz wants Iran gone, says all about him and UA.
Yes. I agree. And by the way, greetings to you, Zarael. But absolutely, you're completely right. I mean, BlackRock Mertz remains BlackRock Mertz, just to say.
That's also coined from the Durand, BlackRock Mertz.
Yeah, it is. Yep.
All right. Matthew says, Iran strikes cause economic meltdown in the West.
Well, who knows? If this war drags on, if the Iranians do what they threaten and close the Straits of Hormuz, I don't want to try and guess what the outcomes of that are going to be. I suspect it will be momentous, but I don't want to predict too much and too much detail, because at that point we're in a different world.
One sec. It's not coming back. There it is. Geostone says, China deal with the UKCA only last till next election.
Yeah. Starmer's visit to China has come in for relentless criticism here in Britain from all the usual people who, talk again about the Chinese threat, the Chinese hacking the phones of British officials, the Chinese building a super embassy, which is going to be a gigantic spy center, the Chinese bribing academics in British universities, all of those things. Now, some of these stories may be true, by the way. I'm not saying that they're not. I mean, the Chinese probably do some or any or all of these things. I am not saying that they don't. But the way that they are being pushed out there is clearly done basically to say we do not want good relations with China. Or any even better relations with China.
But they need money.
They need money.
Exactly. Right. They need money. So off to China he goes. Elza says, once again, Kaya Kallas was spreading lies. This week she claimed that she went to school. Who does believe such nonsense? LOL. Yeah.
Hello, Elsa.
The one bell, the second bell, the third bell, which is a warning. That was just a bizarre speech from her.
She's becoming increasingly bizarre, by the way. I mean, the way she's speaking now, the way she's talking. I mean, she was never very coherent to start with, but I mean, now it's becoming increasingly strange. And calling Ursula a dictator was very strange.
Yeah, well, the calls for her to go are mounting. Yeah. Diamond Jump says, thank you, gentlemen, so very much. Love you both. Thank you for that. Peter says, I hope the Iranian leadership do show bottle when this all or nothing war on Iran begins. Otherwise, Iranian culture and history will become a theme park operated by Disney.
Well, I think that's a fair point. I think there will be some people in Iran who are very, very committed to the regime, the system, system of government, which, remember, is religious. It's religion-based, so they identify their religion with it. I think they will continue to resist, and they will continue fighting, and there will be a significant section of Iranian society that will continue to support them, just to say. It doesn't follow that everybody in Iran will. And Iran is a very difficult country for someone who doesn't study it constantly to really understand. I mean, you have to really get deep into Iranian politics to understand it. But I suspect that there probably has been quite a lot of penetration. Well, in fact, I don't think there's any doubt about it. There's been quite a lot of penetration of the government there. I think even after all that has happened, there are probably lots of people who are taking money, who are acting as agents of the government, or of the CIA, of Mossad, within the political system in Iran.
Grant says, always great listening to the Q&A. Thank you, Grant, for that. The Q&A shows are always great. Herr Kreis says, U.S. Democrats are outraged by Trump's hegemonic behavior, especially regarding Greenland. Is Europe deluding itself into thinking that if Trump is ousted someday, everything will be rolled back?
Some people in Europe believe that. In fact, I'd say that's still the policy. Wait him out. Appease him in the meantime. Go along with whatever demand he makes or appear to, in the hope that in 2028 a new Democrat president will be elected, will roll it all back and bring us back to the blessed times we had under Joe Biden, or the even better times we had under Barack Obama and Bill Clinton. I mean, that's basically to the extent that there is a European policy. That's what they want to be, happy vassals instead of unwilling slaves, as Bart de Wever, the Belgian prime minister, put it. There is another view, which I think is gaining traction, that whatever happens in the United States, even if there's a backlash against Trump domestically, there is no going back to the way things were, that the Europeans and the Americans have now reached a point of divergence, and that the distance between them is going to continue to grow.
Going to locals, Ten Wow says, Iran needs to enrich uranium to a certain extent, as that is needed for medical cancer treatment. Iran was unable to buy such medications due to sanctions.
Yes. And, yes.
Go ahead. Yeah. No. That's the one comment.
I think that is right, and I think that is a valid point. But they went much further than that. They always said that they were never going to acquire a nuclear weapon, and then they went all the way up to 60% enrichment, which I understand is just a step away from obtaining uranium that is sufficiently enriched to actually make a bomb. Now, I don't think that was right or wise. And I would add also that if you want specific amounts of enriched uranium to do certain things of a medical nature, well, in the 1990s and the 2000s and before, you could not have obtained them. But of course, now you're a member of the BRICS, your friends in Russia and China would be perfectly happy to do that for you, just to say.
Yeah. Pathetic Albion says, this conflict against Iran has nothing to do with nuclear enrichment any more than Iraq. That was about WMDs. This is an energy war against the BRICS that should be blindingly obvious.
What it is all about is regime change in Iran. And obviously, damaging the BRICS is part of it. And establishing a foothold again in Central Asia is part of it. But it's also connected to Israel's own policy priorities in the Middle East, because the Israelis have persuaded themselves that Iran is the source of all their problems, which I don't believe, by the way. But it is about regime change. There are all of these excuses that have been made about nuclear enrichment, about ballistic missiles, about all kinds of other things. But ultimately, it is about regime change. What I am saying is this: if you are not going to acquire a nuclear bomb, why enrich to the level of 60% when you're simply giving the other side an excuse to come after you? I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me. It didn't make any sense to many Iranian officials in Iran itself, as they never stopped saying in the run-up to the attack in June last year.
Adir3 says, question for the Duran, if possible. Scott Ritter thinks the best outcome in the next attack on Iran is for the USA to lose a B-2 bomber or two right away, even with Russia's help. Do you agree?
No, I'm not going to get into discussions about that kind of thing. I don't think it's for me to say what Iran should do in terms of destroying American equipment. I'm very, very uncomfortable, very unhappy debating those things. What I would say is this: I would prefer that there be no attack of any kind by the United States at all. If there is an attack, then I could see many, many possibilities, very plausible possibilities for how this could go catastrophically wrong. And in any event, whatever happens, I don't see any good long-term outcome for Iran, obviously, but for the United States also.
Sir Musgame says, by wearing casual attire, were Witkoff and Jared channeling the Duran to give them geopolitical gravitas in front of the Russians, perhaps?
Well
they weren't wearing Duran gear, were they?
No, I mean, I think they were. They would have gone down a lot better, actually. In a negotiation like that, you go informally dressed. I mean, the Americans, I've seen this happen, but I've been in this kind of situation with Americans before. Americans, who can be the most formal people on planet Earth sometimes, can also be the most informal people in settings which to others can seem very inappropriate. And this was one.
Let's go back to locals one sec. From Bill in PA, Iran appears to have the capability of making decapitation strikes against Israel. Is that possible? Is that a possible response to another U.S. or Israeli attack?
Well, you say that they appear. I mean, I haven't seen that myself. Maybe they do. I don't know what exact capabilities they have. During the 12-day war, they showed that their missiles, well, not just before, during the 12-day war, in various missile exchanges beforehand, they showed that their missiles can penetrate Israeli air defenses and can deplete those defenses and can do significant damage. But I'm not going to take charge of Iran's military and tell, you know, and direct the Iranians and tell them how they should respond to an American attack on them any more than I'm going to tell the Americans what they should do to attack in terms of an attack against Iran. What I am saying is stop. I think this is a very, very bad thing that you are doing. A war is not going to work to anybody's long-term advantage. And at this moment in time, I'm also going to say something else. Iran is not attacking the United States. It is not at war with any country. It has clearly had a serious domestic, political, and economic crisis. But it is obviously not a threat to the United States. It is obviously not a threat to Israel either. If Iran's nuclear enrichment program is still such a problem, then what did that 12-day war actually achieve? We were told at the time, you know, the Fordor had right. been destroyed, everything right. had been put back, all of those years and all of that.
Right.
So, you know, already that narrative seems to have been fallen apart. So if there is going to be an attack on Iran now, to me, that looks wrong at a political, geostrategic, moral, and legal level, all of them at once. So that is what I'm going to say.
Yeah, and you know what? You had the JCPOA.
Absolutely.
No one mentions this anymore. The media in the West never mentions the JCPOA anymore. You had the JCPOA. It was the one thing that the Obama administration, you could say, did right.
Yes.
Was the JCPOA.
Exactly.
And it was being enforced, monitored, not by the United States, but by all of these Europeans, I believe, including Germany. So who's Mertz to talk about Iran is going to fall or Iran's days are numbered? Yeah. Mertz, Germany was part of the JCPOA.
Absolutely.
You guys were involved in the JCPOA, which was approved by the United Nations, I believe by the Security Council.
Absolutely.
And Trump pulled out of it. So you had the JCPOA in place.
Exactly.
It was all there. There was no reason to go down this road.
Correct. Absolutely correct.
Peter says, have the rights of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church been worked out in the talks? Will Patriarch Bartholomew have egg on his face by the mess he created?
Well, there's been absolutely no movement on the question of the Orthodox Church. And if you're talking about the Zelensky government, as far as I can see, they're intensifying their persecution of it. So this situation, there's been no agreement or movement on, and I don't expect that this Ukrainian government is going to agree to that. Unless with Bartholomew, well, I'm not going to say anything, because anything I do say, yes, exactly.
Don't say, we better not say anything.
Yeah.
Pre-Newman-Newman. So where is the, I know I pronounced that completely wrong anyway, sorry about that. Where is the legalistic mind of Putin when Russia trades with genocidal state that recreated, by his own words, the images of the Leningrad siege?
Well, let me make one very simple point, which is that the Russians always trade with everybody. and they consider sanctions to be illegal. So that's, if you like, the legalistic mind of Putin at work. I mean, you put it in that way, that is how Putin thinks. I mean, and by the way, on that, I don't get the sense that there's much pushback. For the record, the Palestinians tend to be, in fact, they don't tend to be, they are generally pretty happy with the stance that the Russians are taking. And Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, was recently in Moscow.
Communism rocks, says Alexander. You said recently that you don't consider the U.S. to have similarities to fascist Germany. What are your reasons for holding this view?
Well, because I've studied fascist Germany very closely, and I know what the political system was like there, and I know what the interactions between the military were, and I know what the position of the leaders was. And I think the two countries were completely, not completely, but profoundly and fundamentally different. I may be completely critical of many of the things that the United States is and many of the things that it does, but it is not the same. Just as today's Russia is fundamentally and profoundly different from Stalin's Soviet Union, despite many, many people's attempts to persuade you otherwise.
Westwolf says, left field question, the conspiracy theory doing the rounds that Budanov has been put in place in the event the CIA decides that Zelensky regime needs to be terminated kinetically. Grain of truth?
Possibly. It's not impossible. I don't think Zelensky wanted Budanov to become his chief of staff. But my own view about it, and I've already expressed this, is I think that Budanov's presence there, where he is not so much to take over from Zelensky now. Rather, it is to prepare for the insurgency war, which I think is plan B when Ukraine falls.
Sanjeva says, what will be Trump's legacy if Democrats sweep the midterms? Given the result of by-elections and polling, it might very well be the case. Polarizing PR stunts by ICE also not helping.
Well, you put it mildly. Well, I get to say this. If the Democrats sweep the elections, if they win the House and they win and make big grounds in Congress, I can tell you exactly what they're going to do, because they're Democrats. They're going to start impeachment proceedings. That is what they always do. There is no other. I mean, that is the only thing they know how to do. And they're actually guaranteed. And that might not work out well for them too, by the way.
Yeah. Westwolf Esquire says, A&A, what is the media coverage of domestic US events where you both are?
In Britain, extensive and almost completely wrong. I mean, that is awful, based on no understanding at all. The British media is populated by Democratic Party operatives who basically write our perspectives on the news in the United States.
Same exact situation here in Greece and in Cyprus. Pro-European, pro-EU, pro-EU. Everything is a pro-EU stance here.
Yes.
Jihad says, just the other day in the Dutch news media, 1.2 million Russians killed in the war and 600,000 Ukrainians. They got that from the CNN article as well, Alexander. CNN put out the article about the 1.2. And their source, CNN's source for this number is the... What's that think tank? The CSIS?
Yes.
Is that the think tank? Yeah, that's where they got the number from.
Yes.
So that's what they're basing this number on.
Yes. I don't place any credence on these numbers. I can tell you for a fact. There are.
You know the number. I know everyone knows that you have a very good idea of the numbers, of all the numbers of the casualties. But you haven't said it.
I'm going to say the 600,000 Ukrainians killed is not far from the truth. I mean, it is not the truth. It is not accurate, but it is closer to the truth than any other number that has been given up to this time. The 1.2 million Russians is plucked completely out of the air. Mediazona, for what it is worth, and they are now starting to produce the names of killed Russians. But Mediazona based on open sources, says 160,000, has tracked 160,000 dead Russians as a result of the war. And, well, that is not 1.2 million. So how do you jump from that figure all the way up to 1.2 million? It can't be done.
One day you're going to reveal the numbers, Alexander.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, I will. Oh, well, I'm going to tell you something. The day the war ends, the Russian Defense Ministry will. And then it will be a shock, and there will be denials, and then eventually, gradually, it'll be accepted. This is exactly what happened, by the way, after the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan. I remember at one time, I remember this vividly, that a figure of 250,000 Soviet soldiers killed in Afghanistan was being circulated. I remember, this is the 1980s. I am cursed with a good memory for this sort of thing. And then the war ended, the Soviets pulled out, the Defense Ministry revealed that the actual number that they said was 11,000. There was absolute incredulity. Nobody believed it. And then people went back over the figures in the following years, and they found that, yes, maybe that was a little too low. Maybe it was because they didn't include people who died of their wounds in Russia and ever. And I think the figure has gradually dialed up to about 13,000, 14,000. Right. Pretty close to the figure the Defense Ministry gave.
Yeah. Alexander Ross says, hi, gents. Greetings from Australia. As I write this, it's 10:30 p.m. in New South Wales, 12:30 a.m. in New Zealand, and apparently it's the late 1930s if you're in the European Union or NATO.
Absolutely. A brilliant, brilliant comment, by the way.
Zariel says, well, first, there was a large evacuation in Davos due to a fire. None reported about it. And then he had to drive to the airport the next day, so that must have teed him off, too. We talk about Zelensky, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe.
Didn't know about the fire.
Yeah. I didn't know about the fire. No, it absolutely wasn't reported.
Fuzzyball says, Medvedev is clearly the second highest profile Russian here in the West. Is Medvedev being groomed to replace Putin? He does have the presidential aura.
Well, he's been president already, and he's been prime minister, and he's the deputy chair of the Security Council, which is Russia's highest policy-making body, which meets every week. And he's also the de facto head of Russia's Military Industrial Commission, which is the institution that supervises and runs Russia's military industrial complex. So he's an extremely important man. And I would say that he is, in practical terms, the number two. If Putin suddenly died tomorrow, according to the constitution, the prime minister, Mishustin, would take over as acting president. There would then be elections. I think it's highly likely at that point that we would see a Medvedev being put forward as the candidate for those elections. And I suspect that he would win, and win hands down.
Nico says, now they want to kill Putin, who is the only one who's avoiding World War III. They try to make him look weak so he can be replaced. We are in the end game, Duran.
We might very well be. And by the way, they did try and kill Putin. I agree.
Nico says, I will say we have some good news on the ship front today. Sofia, the Russian ship, was returned to Venezuela. France released the captain of the Grinch.
And Trump, the U.S., returned the two Russian sailors Marinera to Russia. So they don't want to take on the Russian Navy on the high seas. It's not comparable to the U.S. Navy. But the Russians do have some powerful naval assets, especially in their submarines. And anyway, they don't want to get into a direct clash with the Russian military.
Maria, thank you for that super chat. Matlis X says, Alexander, if the U.S. does attack Cuba today, the Russians can again say that they will occupy West Berlin and East Berlin and Warsaw, etc.
Well, I mean, they would have to get there. I mean, that would be World War III. I don't believe the Russians are going to start World War III over Cuba this time, especially given what I said, that the Cubans are not asking them for assistance, which in this situation amazes me. I mean, they should have prepared for this. I mean, putting aside that they should have prepared for this situation long ago, arguably the moment Hugo Chavez died. Instead, of course, they spent a lot of time and intrigues getting Maduro in place and relied on him. But even then, they should have diversified and started to ramp up their imports of oil from Russia. But putting that aside, when Trump was re-elected, and especially back in the autumn, when the US started to move military and naval assets to the Caribbean, that's when they should have got in touch with the Russians and said, look, the situation is turning out very, very difficult, very, very bad. We can't assume that Venezuelan oil is going to come. Can you help us? And the Russians would have said yes, but they did nothing.
Elsa says, is Cuba and, for others, Iran an American obsession like the one the Europeans have with Russia? LaFontaine called the hostility towards Russia a German tradition in politics.
Oscar LaFontaine, who, by the way, is Zara Wagenknecht's partner, did an absolutely brilliant speech on this, and a very moving speech, and I absolutely agreed with him completely. I wish that he had become Chancellor of Germany. Never any prospect that he would have done. He's too left-wing for many people, just to say. But I think on this, he's absolutely, fully, fully right. Is Iran and Cuba an obsession for the US? Yes, to some extent it is.
Yeah.
And obsessions are always bad. A country like the United States can afford obsessions up to a point. Obsessions never do you any good in the end.
For Rubio, Cuba absolutely is.
Absolutely.
And for Lindsey Graham, yes. Iran absolutely is. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Nicholas Walker says, before global issues erupt, are we likely to see national issues within the US, UK, EU lead to internal conflict sooner than later?
Well, again, I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, we are very far in Britain from a total breakdown of law and order. And we remain overall a very law-abiding place. Britain is still a very, very law-abiding place. But levels of anger and disillusion in Britain have reached levels that I have never known before in my lifetime.
From Rumble, Flip Shibby says, thank you for hosting Robert Barnes. Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you for Robert. Thank you to Robert
for joining us. Yeah,
for joining us. Absolutely. Thank you for that super chat from. Oh no, wait. Did we answer that one from Sir Mouse Game? No. It seems Putin has and will always be negotiating past Obama, Biden, and Trump, and directly to the men in dark suits that actually run the U.S.
He talked about that, by the way. I remember him talking about this. Is in the interview he gave to Oliver Stone. He said that he's very well aware of the way the world works and of the way the United States works, that the bureaucracy rules in the United States. Bureaucracy, he means the deep state, and that presidents come and go, but nothing changes. I remember him saying all of those things. Of course, the trouble is, if you are Putin, you can't negotiate really directly with those people. You have to go through the president and his various agencies. And I'm going to say something else. If he did try, if we ever had a situation where Russians and Americans with their deep states came together, they probably wouldn't get very far, because I suspect within the deep state, they absolutely hate the Russians.
Yeah, Fuzzy Ball says, was the Anchorage plan for America to do what they want and Russia takes whatever they want in Ukraine, since America is out of disposable weaponry? They both have been stalling as much as possible.
No, I don't think so. I mean, remember, Anchorage itself, the meeting there lasted all of 1.5 hours. So, I mean, impossible for them, Putin and Trump together, to have come to that kind of incredibly complex and, malevolent agreement. I mean, that can't have happened in Anchorage. Of course, Putin has spoken to Trump many times, but then it doesn't seem as if he talked about that. And you don't agree that kind of plot over the telephone. And Putin has spent time, many, many hours with Witkoff. But again, it doesn't seem to me as if Witkoff is the person where you agree that sort of plot either. I don't think it's worked out like that. I think what's more likely, I'm not saying this is true, is that what, but I think what's more likely is that one of the reasons Trump is thrashing out in all directions, Venezuela, Iran, and all of the rest, is because he is deeply frustrated by his failure to get what he wants from Putin in terms of the Ukraine war. I think that probably does play a role in these decisions. And, you know, he's trying in a kind of a way, because he has some kind of strange thing about Putin, which, I mean, he sort of admires him and is scared of him and resents him all at the same time, it seems to me, that he's both trying to get Putin's attention and impress him as well by saying, well, you know, you may be winning in Ukraine, but look what I can do. I can overthrow your friend in Venezuela and come after your friend in your friends in Iran. I can do all of this. So I think there is some element of that playing out here.
Yeah, he respects them as equals, as peers, like Xi and Putin.
Yeah.
But he sees himself as the greater of all of them. So I think on a personal level, there's Trump wanting to deliver a defeat to Putin and to Xi, while at the same time respecting them. But he wants to say, look, I am the big dog in this group.
Exactly.
Yeah. Nico says, you might not like Putin meeting Jelani, but people in Russia have accepted this reality. I don't like Putin meeting the Taliban, but it is what it is.
Some people in Russia don't like it. But I mean, they will accept it because they always, for the various reasons that people have said. I mean, it makes sense from a realpolitik point of view. And Russia is a very realpolitik place, just to say.
Yeah. Man for Today says, we thought Ukraine couldn't last 2025 and 2026.
Well, who knows? I'm not sure who exactly said that Ukraine would not last through 2025. If it was just Ukraine, by the way, if it was just Ukraine fighting the Russians, then it wouldn't have lasted through 2022. Just saying.
Yeah. Sparky6086. Sparky. I don't know why I said the whole handle, Sparky. Anyway, could China have propped up the Iranian currency without asking Iran? Did they ask Iran and after being turned down, didn't do it because it would have been rude? Should they just have done it?
It's not the Chinese way. I mean, they wouldn't have intervened by supporting someone else's currency in that sort of way. By the way, I didn't know that governments generally step in. I mean, if we're looking at Argentina, for example, it was Milei who basically approached the Americans for help. And of course, the Americans were very happy to give it. I didn't get the sense that the Americans came along to Milei and told him you know, to ask us. Maybe they did. But anyway, the Chinese don't do that. And what the Chinese could have done by themselves is one thing. But what Iran should have done, and remember, we're talking about Iran and about the situation in Iran, which is the responsibility of the Iranian government at the end of the day, not the Chinese government. Iran's government itself should have done that. They should have come to China and said, look, we're having this crisis. Somebody is shorting the rial. It's creating a crisis in the financial markets in Dubai. It's destabilizing our economy. Can you help us? And the Chinese would have done it. They'd already said that. And so one shouldn't shift responsibility onto China when, as I said, it's Iran's responsibility, the responsibility of the Iranian government to come to China and ask for help. Now, I'm going to say, I think one of the problems, one of the reasons the Iranians don't do that is because there are all kinds of lobbies in Iran that worry that if they do that, then the Chinese will come and will demand economic concessions. in China. Just as I think that one of the reasons why the Iranians have been very reluctant to buy weapons from Russia, even though they've been offered, is because Iran has a significant arms industry. And the people who run that don't want the Russians coming in and providing weapons which will compete with the weapons that they're producing within Iran. But those lobbies always exist in every country. A strong government looks at the practical realities, understands that Iran needs help, and says, whatever our feelings, whatever our long-term concerns, we must deal with the situation that has arisen now. And they didn't do that.
Yeah, you made the point that a couple of billion is all Iran would have needed, and China would have given it. Iran needs to use BRICS. That's what it's there for.
Exactly. Why did he join BRICS in the first place? If it's not going to make use of BRICS, which it hasn't done up to now. Yeah. There's been some sporadic attempts to create rail links and all of that kind of thing. But there's none of the energy and commitment to this project that you would have expected.
VVT7VVT says, if even a head butcher like Jelani can be invited to the White House and the Kremlin, are there really any moral lines in international politics?
Well, it seems not.
Good question. Matlis X says, Alexander, you need to spend an extended amount of time here in the U.S. to write about the sentiment of Americans 200 years after the Tocqueville. Go to red and blue states, rural areas and cities, dining rooms and cafes.
I've just been invited to visit one and might be going to a particular U.S. state away from the East Coast in August, just to say.
Very cool.
This may be coming.
All right. Nico says, I am sorry for being emotional, Duran, but seeing these recruitment ads in Greece of all places, it's just depressing. I'm young. I am not reserved.
You're absolutely right, TB. I'm depressed as well.
Mm-hmm. All right. That's from Nikos. Thank you, Nikos. Klempa says, important. Who will win in Hungary?
I still think, in spite of everything, that it will be Orbán. But this is obviously, there's obviously uncertainties. But I can't help but think that in the end, Orbán took a catastrophic situation in Hungary, turned it round, stabilised Hungary. There's been considerable economic growth and a return to prosperity there. I think that he obviously is far and away the biggest political figure in Hungary. All of these things will work in his favour, and I think that in the end he will win. But there is no doubt at all that this is the biggest challenge that he's faced up to this time. I'm not saying it's a certainty that he will win, and you're absolutely right. It matters hugely who wins.
Yeah, Orbán made Hungary into a player, and Hungary's not a big country.
No.
Orbán turned Hungary into a big player on the world stage. If that Magyar guy wins, Hungary's just going to be another vassal in the EU machine.
Yes.
In the US EU machine, yeah. Exactly. Paul Walker says, Fukang Chinese envoy just warned against military adventurism in Iran. Says any US military action is an act of war at the UN. Two Scots were kidnapped by the US.
I need to find the Scott story. About the two Scots. I need to find out about. But yes, the Chinese are saying these things. The Russians, no doubt, will too before long. I think that's going to in itself stop the events that we're seeing play out, take place.
Salman says, big thanks to both for amazing work and analysis. Thank you for that. Sparky says, Scott Bessent learned the art of crashing currencies from his master, George Soros.
Absolutely true.
Sparky. Very true. Demerch says, great analysis, lads. I follow Duran and both of your channels daily, the best sources for all things going on in the world, and particularly Ukraine. Would love to see a collaboration video with YouTuber Willie OAM sometimes. You know, I got to get in touch with Willie OAM, to be quite honest. I would like that collaboration as well. So I don't know if Willie OAM is watching this live stream or if someone can get in contact with him, have him reach out. I know he's a realist, but he's more on the Ukraine side of things with the conflict. Mm-hmm. But I like his work, and I think he's He's a really intelligent guy. So yeah, if someone knows Willie, OAM, have him reach out to us. That would be cool. Right. Salim says, how serious do you take Carney's speech?
I don't. I'm sorry. I mean, I've said this many times. I don't think Carney expected it to get the attention that it got, actually. I think he thought he was being very pleasant. Remember, he was talking to Davos. So I think he thought that he was going to make a nice splash and say something that the people in Davos would, you know, be happy about and applaud. I think when it went viral and went around the world and got to Donald Trump himself, I think that wasn't what he expected, and it wasn't what he wanted. To repeat again, what he says is that this fraud, the rules-based international order from which we all benefited, from which we, not all of us, we, I and my friends, you in this room, benefited. This has now failed. So we need to start on our next fraud. That is not something that I particularly applaud. I mean, I don't understand why anybody outside that hall does.
Everyone's like, why are you saying this, Carney? Why are you admitting this?
Exactly.
Well, that's why people were upset with Carney. Well, he wasn't supposed to say that part out loud.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Here's from Nikos. I didn't answer this. I made two lists, top 10 best and top worst Russian leaders. Are you interested to see my historical rankings?
Oh, I need
permission to send them
to
you. Yeah, send it to
us,
Nikos.
Send it to us.
I think you have our contact details. Yeah. Send it to us. That'd be cool to see. Sir Muggs Game says, there will never be any type of signing ceremony between Russia, the U.S., and Ukraine. That's horse and buggy thinking. An artifact consigned to the past.
I agree, actually. I mean, the idea that there's going to be a treaty, I just don't think it's ever going to happen. The closest we got to it was in Istanbul in April 2022, and we saw what happened.
Yeah. Alexandrovich says, I really appreciate your program and the way you offer perspectives beyond those of mainstream Belgium media. In your opinion, what can ordinary people do to make alternative voices heard, especially regarding Russia-Ukraine conflict?
Well, I mean, you can try and argue with people. Not always easy thing to do. But, you know, why don't you suggest to them, you know, why don't you go and listen to alternative takes? Why don't you go and subscribe to the Duran?
That's right. Subscribe to Duran, everybody. And like this video. Hit that like button. Leonard Schellenberg says, is a new member. Welcome to the Duran community. Dental says, some say the Ukraine conflict is a form of World War III. I think World War 2.2 is more apt. Was the UK and Reich III coming to blows just down to Adolf not being a team player or what?
I think the diplomacy of the 1930s and early 1940s is very, very remote from our world today. And it has its roots very much in the events of the last years of the 19th century, early 20th century, and the Second World War, and the general crisis that was affecting Britain and its empire at that time. So I don't think one should try and read back events of that time, thinking in the world that we do today, just to say. So is it World War III? Is it World War II? I don't mind the Ukraine war. I don't think it is any of that. I think it is a very, very important conflict in Europe, the most important conflict that has taken place since the Second World War. It has reshaped the global international environment. There was an article, by the way, by a British journalist called Liam Halligan in the Daily Telegraph that admitted that very thing. It said the war in Ukraine has changed the world, which it has. But that still doesn't make it World War II or World War III. I hope we never get there.
Yeah. Hello there says, could you do an updated show on the Russian economy? Any news on new payment systems, and do they have links to central banks stockpiling gold?
I'm sure they, on the last point, I'm sure they do. And the Reserve Bank of India is now proposing connecting up the various digital currencies that the various BRICS central banks are either going to operate or are already operating. So, yes. Now, about the Russian economy, we should be getting a raft of data at some point over the next few weeks. And when that comes through, yes, definitely we will do a follow-up program.
Absolutely. Sparky says, China propped up the Hong Kong dollar during their transition back to China, spoiling Bessent's attempt to crash it and profit from a short position. Bessent still holds a grudge and acts accordingly.
Completely true. I remember it very well. I would add that China is in a very, very much stronger position today to support Iran than it was then with the Hong Kong dollar.
Yeah. Sir Musgame says, the U.S. forced Aussies to cancel French submarine deal. Now they are to begin forced to cancel the sale of the port of Darwin to China. Five eyes indeed. Problem is, four are blind, number one.
Yeah, I think you're making very, very valid points. I mean, the Americans are never satisfied. If you give them something, they will always come back for more. When I say the Americans, I want to make it very clear. I am talking about the American political and military and bureaucratic leadership. So you can never end. You can never do things by halves with them. Either you say no at the beginning, or if you say yes, you're going to find that they will always come back and demand more from you.
Sparky says, let's hope, God forbid, the need arises, Iran doesn't hold back this time. It could cause a long period of world peace.
Well, they are saying they won't hold back. We'll see whether they follow up with that.
Fallen Crow says, the idea that Iran's nuclear program instigated this aggression is silly. If no WMD program existed, they would invent one like they did with Iraq.
I think you misunderstand my point entirely. I didn't say that. What I said was, what is the point? What is the logic of increasing nuclear enrichment up to 60% levels if you're not going to take the next step beyond that? All you're doing is you're giving the other side a pretext to attack you, without in any way deterring it. And if you're trying to gain leverage, that makes no sense either. I said very clearly that, first of all, the point I have made is one that Iranian officials, including, by the way, the former head of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, who was assassinated by the Israelis in June, also made. I mean, they could not understand Khamenei's reasoning, and I don't understand it. But I've always said this is a regime change operation. The American pretexts for it change all the time. And I've also said that Iran is a country at peace with all of the other surrounding countries and poses no threat to the United States, and that an attack on Iran now is completely wrong and entirely unjustified.
Tim Gibson, thank you for that super sticker. Claudia says, Europe turns first to China, then later to Russia.
Who knows? I don't think so. I don't think so myself. Not with these leaders that we have now.
No. Some countries in Europe over time. Yeah. Will turn to Russia, some of the smaller countries. I'm saying countries like Cyprus, for example, or like maybe, I don't know, the Maltas or the Bulgarias or whatever, but the big countries, it's going to take time.
Yeah.
Maybe Italy, Alexander, maybe the first, or Spain. I don't know.
Yes, Italy could very well be, yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Pertinax, the reformer, sorry, unrelated to current events. Alexander, what do you think about Yugoslavia, 1945 to 1991?
I used to go to the old Yugoslavia very often, and I used to know it very, very well. And I thought it was a wonderful country, just to say. I mean, there were aspects of its political system that I found very strange. I did not share, by the way, in the adulation that existed at that time in the West of the Yugoslav leader, Josip Broz Tito. I thought that he was I thought he was a very corrupt, visibly corrupt man, but he did seem to know how to keep Yugoslavia together. Well, I didn't get the sense at that time that it needed very much to hold it together for quite a long time. It seemed to be doing rather well. And compared to the other countries, you know, that were communist, it certainly was very, very much more relaxed and open to the West. And there were private businesses and there was private enterprise. And it's a lovely place. And it was peaceful. It was certainly a much happier place, I suspect, that any one of the republics that made up the former Yugoslavia are today.
Alexander Ross says, as elections in Hungary draw near, what lengths do you think EU leaders might stoop to for Viktor Orban's removal, Robert Fico's ordeal in mind?
There are any lengths. There are no limits. They will do everything they possibly can, and one should be ready for it.
Mm-hmm. Sir Muggs Game says, being assigned to Middle East is a demotion for Russian and Chinese diplomats. It's the devil's playground. No offense.
No, it's not true. Actually, the Russians have an extremely well-trained and a very, very well-informed cadre of diplomats in the Middle East. Unlike the Americans, they all speak Arabic, for example. I happen to know this. I mean, they have very highly qualified people in the Middle East. I don't know about the Chinese. I cannot comment about the Chinese. But the Russians have always taken the Middle East extremely seriously. And the fact that they've been able to navigate and achieve good relations with so many countries in the Middle East, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, all the Gulf's monarchies, Jalali in Syria, is a reflection of the caliber of the diplomats they have there.
Claudia says, I'm worried that Dmitriev talks could lead to bad business deals for Russia.
I don't think so. I get to tell you something about Dmitriev. By the way, I'm not a great fan of Dmitriev, and I absolutely do not think that he should be involved in negotiations over Ukraine, not in any way. I mean, I think he's completely out of his depth there. But what I know about Dmitriev is that in Russian terms, he's very much an economic nationalist, in the sense that, yes, he believes, you know, free markets and, you know, that sort of thing, private enterprise, and his job is to attract external investment into Russia. But he's absolutely somebody who believes Russia should reindustrialize, work to develop its own supply chains, build up the domestic manufacturing economy, retain control of its natural resources, which is one reason, by the way, why he has he's actually held in quite well regard by some people within the nationalist patriotic camp of Russian politics as well.
From Sparky, beginning sometime in 2025, many Verizon cell phones could send 140 characters or fewer text messages via Starlink. Insurgents in Iran could use such cell phones. 140 characters is plenty to coordinate.
Oh, absolutely, indeed. And that was one of the reasons why there was so much attempt to use Starlink in the protests. And for the moment, at least, it seems as if that was counted. But Starlink is going to evolve. They're going to try and find means to deal with the jamming. This is far from ended. It's a constant game between the Russians, the Chinese, and Starlink. The Russians are now starting their own equivalent bubble.
Yeah. Sticky Mark says, full disclosure, my now all grown up grandchildren call me Nana Weirdo. Thank you for that, Sticky Marks. Sir Muzz Game says, I love the way the Greeks call every POTUS Planetarchis, planet ruler. Will Trump be the last with this title, or will it be the next POTUS, Hunter Biden?
Very good comment.
It's true, the Greeks do call them the planet ruler. That is a word that we use. Absolutely. Yeah. Good message, Sir Muzz Game. Matthew says, best analysis out there. Thanks, chaps. Are you optimistic or pessimistic regarding how things eventually play out?
I'm optimistic for the long term, very, very pessimistic about the short term. And of course, it's the short term we all live in.
Yeah. Bisatoon says, Iran has the ability to spoof GPS, which can jam Starlink.
Yeah.
Sparky says, it's possible the Verizon Starlink text message feature was released to the massive Verizon system outage concurrent with the recent Mossad-induced Iranian riots.
probably. I mean, I'm not the best person to comment about these technical things. All I can tell you is that there was a successful jamming of Starlink, and it did create a lot of dismay in the United States.
All right, Garland Nixon.
Oh, Garland Nixon, our great friend. Greetings to you. We should have you on soon, just to say.
Yeah, we should do a show very soon. You're free, Garland. Let's get together. The Dems are working tirelessly on a ceasefire in Minneapolis, just like they did with Gaza.
Absolutely. You are probably the best person, by the way, to discuss the whole Minneapolis.
Let's hook up next week. Absolutely. Whenever your schedule is free, Garland, hit us up and let's do a show if you'd like.
But also, as somebody with your background in law enforcement, yeah. I mean, and your understanding of all the politics, you are the best person to discuss it with.
Yeah. Drago is a new member to the Duran community. Mm. Dabri Casario says, do you think that the U.S. dollar will collapse, and will the collapse of the U.S. dollar save the U.S. because it is unbearable right now?
You know, when we talk about collapse, we need to be very careful what we mean. If you mean, is the United States heading towards hyperinflation so that its currency loses all value, like the Reichsmark did in Weimar Germany, well, then I don't expect that to happen. Not now, not anytime soon. If you mean, will the USD one day lose its position as the global reserve currency, then the answer to that is unequivocally yes. And in my opinion, that will be a liberating moment for the United States. It will mean that the US currency will eventually come to be used for the purpose of the United States itself, which it always should have done. In other words, to promote American business, American industry, American economic activity, and not as a tool for empire around the world.
Trevor Watt says, have you considered hosting Simon Dixon? He's been posting a lot of compelling geopolitical and economic thoughts lately. Thanks.
Yeah.
We should. We've been getting many messages to do something with Simon Dixon.
Yes,
we should reach out.
Yeah. Yes.
Thank you for that. Game of Chair says, is Japan's currency crisis the start of a shift in global finance?
We talked about this. I think it could be very, very big, actually, given how important Japan is and given the size of the debt liabilities that the Japanese government holds. I understand that the days when Japan could cover all these debts from the savings of the Japanese population are ending because Japan completely failed to deal with its demographic problems, which go back very far to the early 1980s. So it's definitely something to look into. And maybe somebody who understands the situation in Japan would be a good person to speak to as well.
Sparky says, the great Garland Nixon noticed the seeming coincidence between the massive Verizon outage and the violent riots in Iran.
Yeah.
Interesting. Nico says, I'm interested in the Russian parliamentary elections. While people support President Putin and his cabinet, the United Russia ruling party is mixed to 47%.
Well, it still makes it by many orders of magnitude the most popular party in Russia. But Putin himself has always been far more popular than United Russia. Just to say, I mean, and remember, he's not even a member of United Russia. Mm. So when you call it the ruling party, I think that's something of a misconception, because it's not United Russia, the party which rules Russia. It is Putin and the officials in the Kremlin who rule Russia. And they use United Russia as a mechanism, as a party that owes allegiance to them, and which helps them to control the Duma, the Russian parliament. It's a different political system from ours. It doesn't mean that it is an authoritarian or dictatorial one in the way that many people in the West say.
Saddam says the EU will be back on Russian energy like white on rice when the war ends.
I would love to think so. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be so sure. First of all, will the Russians want to sell after all that's happened? I mean, bear in mind, it was already a horrible business for the Russians from long before 2022. I mean, they were having to face court cases, regulations. They were being harassed all the time. It had become an absolute nightmare for them. And I remember, I think it was in 2012, before the Ukraine crisis, that the Russians, that Gazprom made a decision that it wasn't going to build any more pipelines to Europe because the business there had become so difficult. And then Merkel and Putin did the deal over Nord Stream 2, and Gazprom had to comply, which they did through gritted teeth, and the rest is history.
Look, the Russians have no problem dealing with sovereign countries in Europe, like Hungary.
Yeah,
I think they'll be happy to do energy deals with individual countries in Europe. The problem is the European Union. No one wants to deal with the European Union, and the Russians do not want to deal with the European Union and all of their whining and their regulations and their complaining. They don't want to deal with any of that.
In fact, Merkel promised Putin that because of the way in which the Nord Stream 2 pipeline was built, skirting, going through the Baltic Sea, that it wouldn't be within European Union territory, that the European Union would have no role, no ability to stop, block, interfere, or harass it. And she gave Putin that guarantee, exactly what Alex says.
Sparky says insurgents don't need
The word of Merkel.
The word of Merkelism,
yeah.
Sparky says insurgents don't need a full-blown Starlink terminal to communicate. A normal-looking cell phone would suffice. 140 characters or fewer messages is enough. They don't need to surf the internet.
I understand that, as I said, the jamming has taken many forms, and I'm not going to discuss it because, as I said, this isn't me. This is not what I am best able to talk about. But yes, you're absolutely right.
Zizi Karyanis, thank you for that super sticker. Nikos says, we talk about President Putin's time, but I've never seen a Russian leader his age so active besides Stalin. I think he'll retire in 2030, endorsing Dumin, but he'll surpass Stalin in longevity.
Well, quite possibly. By the way, at Putin's age, Stalin was visibly ill. Remember, Stalin died when he was 73, which is, I think, not far up, much older than Putin is already. And if you know Soviet history, Stalin had his first stroke in 1943 during the war, and he skipped increasingly. He became almost invisible to the Soviet public in the 1940s after the war. And it's known that he was very, very ill for some time before he died. So, I mean, you know, Putin is much, much more vigorous and vital than Stalin is. Stalin was.
Gregory says, Alexander, you have to admit there are a few parallels between the U.S. empire trajectory and fascist Germany, at least going back to the Patriot Act.
Well, there are. I mean, you know, one can find parallels, but one shouldn't overemphasize them. The two countries are profoundly different. The character of the people is completely different too, by the way, just to say.
Fuzzyball says, Shanghai silver price closed at $134.31 an ounce USD. COMEX here in the US is $119.44, which is going to devastate European banks who hold massive short positions.
Wow.
Thank you for that, Fuzzyballs. Sir Mouse Game says, Trump wants Starmer, Macron, Mertz, and Zelensky to be the next U.S. and Russian negotiations. Someone has to park the cars and serve the drinks, I guess. Thank you for that, Sir Buzzgame. Irini says, EU elite follow the Zionist agenda. Christian Zionism is being promoted, which does not even exist. Thoughts? Why von der Leyen, I guess, von Diel, promoted the Talmud in the EU parliament, Christianity being under attack?
Well, all I can say about this is that the extent to which Christianity is under attack from the dominant political forces in Britain, here in Britain, really astonishes me. For example, it is now absolutely standard for British political leaders, you know, the Prime Minister, the leader of the opposition, to congratulate people in Britain on pretty much every single religious and secular holiday that you can think of, except I noticed that they stopped doing it for Christmas and Easter. Just to say.
Yeah. Stefano Ruski says, what do you think the future of the U.S. is? Will it become an American union of sorts with less Fed control? Do you think the U.S. would stay together? The way things are now is not sustainable.
It is not sustainable. But if the United States changes course, which I always hope it will, and you know I'm always disappointed, but if it changes course, it still has time. It could become an extremely happy and wonderful place. It has all the reasons why it should be. It is squandering its future by engaging in all of these absurd plans and policies and projects in the present.
Punnage Production says, why does Trump want Greenland? Is it actually because of security, or is there an alternative reason like resources?
I don't myself think it's resources. I mean, I think, again, the resources in Greenland almost certainly have been overstated. I think that there's a confluence of two things. Firstly, Trump's vanity. I mean, I think Alex said it. I mean, he wants to increase the size of the United States. Greenland is big. America is big. He wants to make America even bigger. Thomas Jefferson bought Louisiana. Andrew Johnson bought Alaska. Donald Trump is going to buy Greenland. I mean, it feeds that side of him. But contrary to what a lot of people say, I think there is actually a strategic rationale to this, which is I think the United States has seen, especially over the last year, how weak its European allies are. At the same time, it also understands that, as they said last year, they can't be in Europe forever. Given that that is so, they need to control the North Atlantic, because the North Atlantic provides access to the American mainland. How do you control the North Atlantic? How do you stop ships, surface ships from Russia? Obviously have to be Russia, traveling through to the North Atlantic, you control Greenland. I think that is the strategic calculus behind this.
Sashan, thank you for your super sticker. Sticky Mark says, great work, lads. Thank you. Thanks to you and all here. Thank you so much, Sticky Marks. Kev Jones, thank you so much for that super chat. West Wolf says, Alexander is 100% correct. The West treats Medvedev as a clown, but talk to Russians in Russia. He is highly respected and embodies many Russian frustrations.
Agreed.
Thank you for that. Tekhano Ruski says, will Putin ever drop some balls? His photo must be right by the word lenient in the dictionary. At this point, everybody will think they can do just about anything to Russia, and they'll be showing restraint.
Yes, this is the thing that people always say all the time. He does show restraint. And he has dropped balls. He did this in 2024, November 2024, when Biden and Starmer and all of these people launched missiles into Russia. I mean, pre-2014 Russia. And Putin had previously said that that was a red line. And the Russians basically did nothing. I mean, they didn't respond as aggressively as many had expected. They carried out one strike with the Oreshnik against the Yuzhmash factory. But the real response against the West never materialized. And he did that because Trump said that this was going to end after he became president, and that he vehemently opposed it, and Putin trusted him. So Putin does drop balls, and he does make mistakes, and he does act with too much restraint sometime. But overall, I would say that he's defended Russian interests very effectively up to now. He has not made any concessions to the West over Ukraine, not since the start of the special military operation.
Yeah, agreed. If Putin can be guilty of something, let's say, would be having too much trust in the West, whether it's Merkel or Trump in a way.
Absolutely.
But you know, Merkel with Minsk and Trump with what you said, A lot of people forget that Trump, as he was campaigning, said no long-range missile strikes into Russia, no more.
Yes, yes.
That's what he said as Biden was launching those missiles. And Putin trusted him.
And then he gave a whole interview, I think it was to Time magazine, Trump did, after he was elected, before he became president, during the transition period, in which he said he vehemently opposed him. Yeah. And then, of course, a few months later, he's authorizing drone strikes all over Russia and getting the CIA to do it.
Yeah. Megashan says, hello, gentlemen. Can we talk about the insurgency of demoralized Israeli soldiers into Patagonia? It looks upsetting.
I don't know anything about the story. This is Patagonia in Argentina?
In Argentina. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And then fires in Patagonia, I believe, and Malays, bizarre behavior. There's a lot going on there. I've been getting some information on it, but I'm still trying to put it all together.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot going on in Argentina, actually. Pinter Hall says gold and silver are telling us a war or de-dollarization or a credit crisis is on the way.
All three. Why not all three?
Yeah. Sir Mugs Game says Alexander is going to the USA. Damatyasu dekadesera. Thank you, Sir Mugs Game. West Wolf Esquire says, who was a winner in Davos? Justin Trudeau.
Very true, exactly. Yes.
A generational run from Justin Trudeau. Oreo de Pup says, why do you think Russia and China refrain from supporting Iran directly?
Well, I think, again, this is a question that is constantly being brought up. You can only help people who ask for help. I think that there is nobody now any longer disputes that Iran, the Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC, did ask for help to suppress, to jam Starlink, and they got it, and it worked. So they do get help when they ask for it. If they don't ask for it, there's a limit to what the Chinese and the Russians can do. You cannot help people who will not help themselves. It is that straightforward.
From Gregory, I really think the U.S. will descend to fascism as it cannot deal with the loss of hegemony. The power elite will turn in on us, its own citizens.
I know that view exists, and I know it's very widespread in the United States. I absolutely hope and pray it doesn't happen.
Sanopin says the EU Commissioner for Energy has just realized that switching dependence from Russian pipeline gas to U.S. LNG was probably not a good idea. Really? Was there a statement?
I haven't seen it. If it has come, well, all I can say is it's nice to see that the light bulb has suddenly switched on.
Tejano Ruski says, do you expect the globalist conglomerate to disintegrate shortly after the Ukraine conflict is over?
Well, I mean, we have the great Mark Carney telling us as much, so why shouldn't we think it?
Yep. West Wolf Esquire says, end of the EU required for Russian reconciliation?
Yes, I agree. I think so. I think that the EU, it's become absolutely clear, is structurally, like every single pan-European alliance that excludes Russia, the EU will always be hostile to Russia. It is a structural reality that will never change.
Yinka 661 says, the real geopolitical war the US is fighting in an attempt to regain its economic sovereignty is with the British. Discuss.
That's a huge, huge topic. I know many people think this. Matt Eret is a good example, but many others too. Alex Craner sometimes. I get to say this. As I said, I used to be fairly close to the financial world in London. I'm not anymore, but you know, I still have some contacts. These people seem very depressed to me. I mean, the word I'm getting is that London's role as a financial center now is very, very, very diminished, even as compared to what it was 20 years ago. I don't get the sense that London is at the center of some great spider's web of finance, which basically controls the US. I'm not an expert on financial matters, but certainly that's my own thinking now. I think you want to understand where the control of finance is. I think it's not, in fact, centered in any one particular place. I think it's all over the world, but the predominant part of it is actually American. That's my sense anyway.
Tejano Ruski says, U.S., Russia, Saudi, UAE control the oil market. Do you think the U.S. would ever get its stuff together to make that happen?
Yes, I think it's a brilliant, from an American point of view, it's a brilliant idea. Putin has pointed it out to Trump. I believe MBS has also done so. The U.S. has never really acted on that.
Osgard said, about the EU-India deal effect on Turkey's custom deal. People concerned in Turkey with the economy. Do you see the EU can evolve the Turkey relation to a serious level?
I think the Turks have every right to be angry, actually. I mean, they've been knocking on the door to get into the EU since the early 1960s.
Years, 40 years.
I mean, you know, and they're constantly being passed over. And now we have this talk about the mother of all deals with India and all of that. So I think the Turks have every good reason for grievance and for anger. I don't know what they're going to do about it. Well, I would tell them what to do about it. Forget about the EU. Start getting closer and closer to the BRICS. What else can they do? They're a part of the state of the BRICS.
Yeah, it's not Erdogan style, though. Erdogan is playing both sides always, yeah. Wanderer says, does Russia have the capability to take over and hold Odessa? Any outcome without taking over Odessa and joining Transnistria with Russia should be seen as an interim truce instead of a Russian victory.
Well, I agree with that, and many people in Russia are saying it. I have always said this. I do not see any outcome to this war which does not involve, in some form, in some way, the Russians regaining some control over Odessa. I think that is a Russian objective. I think it became very clear at the end of last year that it was, by the way. And Gerasimov, the chief of general staff, had a picture in which Odessa was marked in as Russian territory. Do they have the capability? Yes, but it's a long road to get there and a lot of problems to get there. But, I mean, they will get there in the end. And the other thing to say is if they do get to Odessa, it's going to remain Russia forever. There is absolutely no conceivable way, no negotiation, no possible manner in which the Russians will ever give up Odessa again. Not happening.
Alexander Ross says, might Russia's new Zorky satellite be a game changer for Russia and a possible foil to Starlink?
Yes. So I've heard.
Jeff Bickford, thank you for that super sticker. Sparky says, Alex and Alexander, your work is terrific as always. Thank you a million times. Thank you, Sparky, for the support. Sir Musgame says, guests are great, but the chemistry between Alex and Alexander is always geopolitical gold. Many tried to copy, all have failed. Have a good weekend. Thank you, Sir Muggs, for that. Thank you for your great messages as well. Ragnar says, how much Jewish influence is there in Moscow?
Very little, I'd say. If you're talking about influence in terms of, you know, support for Israel and that sort of thing, the Russians make their own decisions about relations with any particular country. There are people within the Russian government who have Jewish backgrounds, but their loyalty is to Russia.
SPM Channel says, what's your thoughts on Xi's firing of the military commission members? There's nearly no one left.
We talked about it earlier in the program. As I said, I think that there is a corruption issue, but I think a lot of it, the ultimate cause of it, is this enormous expansion in the Chinese military that's taken place, which is creating all sorts of stresses, which explain that why there's been tensions between the political and military leadership and why the politicians might not be entirely trusting of the military leaders at this time.
Sparky says, in my opinion, Ted Postol was trying to categorize the Oreshnik as not so devastating, so Western leaders not sophisticated in such matters wouldn't confuse or conflate it as nuclear and respond with nuclear.
I think you are partly true. I mean, what Ted Postol very correctly is very, very worried about the drift towards a possible nuclear confrontation and potential nuclear war. Bear in mind that in about, was it 10 days' time, the only arms control agreement left, the New START treaty, expires. And we are in the first time since the 1960s in a world where there is no nuclear arms limitation control whatsoever. So he's absolutely right to be concerned about this. And he went out of his way to explain that the Oreshnik is not a nuclear weapon. It doesn't work like that. It isn't as devastating as nuclear weapons are. And that responding to an Oreshnik strike by using nuclear weapons is completely inappropriate and would be an absolutely criminal escalation. So he that is obviously and definitely one of his great concerns. But I think that claims that have been made that he downplayed the effect of the Oreshnik are wrong. If you actually listen to him carefully, he went out of his way to say that this is a devastating weapon, that there is no defense to it. His one point was that the warheads are not designed to penetrate deep under the surface. And by the way, it's been suggested to me that, yes, that is true, but that the surface tremors that they create when they crash are so enormous that underground structures like bunkers would undoubtedly be damaged as a result of an Oreshnik strike, even if the warheads don't penetrate below the surface. So that's what he was saying, but he was not disputing the devastating effect of one of the strikes.
Sir Mugs Game says, any YT commentators, aka sofa samurais, urging Putin to strike US NATO are clearly suffering from severe and chronic erectile dysfunction. No. Yes. That Sir Mugs Game. Mad CVNT says, you guys are wrong about Greenland, but I support your efforts and channel anyways. We need your voices.
Thank you for that. We all have the right to disagree, which is an excellent thing,
you.
By the
Thank
way.
Thank you so much. Takano Ruski says, never before in history had a major empire put itself on the line for an artificial welfare state, especially in the imperial end days. Do you see Israeli hold over American everything dissipating?
I think over time, yes. I think people are becoming more critical of Israel and the United States, but clearly their influence in the current administration, as in the previous administration, remains enormous. And they still have many, many friends there. As for welfare states, well, people don't know it, but the Roman Empire eventually evolved into something of a welfare state. For example, the Roman government gave people free bread. Being a Roman citizen in Rome meant that you had automatic rations of free bread every day.
Sparky says the Oreshnik impact causes its metal, such as tungsten, to liquefy and vaporize, makes it like a giant anti-armor shaped charge. Without the shaped charge, its hyperspeed is enough.
Yes, exactly. I mean, there's been lots of commentaries about this, and we're getting more and more sense of what this weapon does. And perhaps the fact that it is enormously devastating, the confirmation of it is that the Ukrainians are not providing us with any actual information about the damage, which suggests that it has been enormous.
Exactly. From the last week's live stream, Alexander, we didn't get to this question from Elsa. Are there already pictures of Macron at the WEF? Will he be the red eye Terminator, the Top Gun sunglasses guy, or the pirate like Schultz? Yeah, those sunglasses from Macron.
All of those. Exactly. Yes.
He stole the show with those sunglasses.
He stole the show.
Yeah. Micheline Adelaide says, why do you think that the U.S. Let me put it up here. One sec. Why do you think that the USA, Ukraine, and Russia are also interested in control of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant?
Ukraine is interested in the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant because they are short of electric power. The United States, because Trump wants to control the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. The Russians say is because he wants to mine. He wants to use it for mining. Cryptocurrencies. That's what they're saying. The Russians say, and it's very straightforward, the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant is ours, and we're not there to share it with anybody. If a deal is done and there's an independent Ukraine, well, perfectly happy to supply Ukraine with electricity from it. probably at a price, but it is ours and there's nothing more to discuss. That's the position.
Yeah. Sparky says the tremors from the Erezhnik may liquefy the ground like the earthquake which destroyed Port Royal, the old pirate headquarters.
Yes.
Peter says, what do you say about Berletic's take on Greenland?
I haven't followed it, actually. This is because I've been very, very busy on things. But my own personal view about Greenland, I think I've already set out. I think that it's vanity in one respect, and I think it's also about control of the North Atlantic in the other.
Internet veteran says, given Trump's ego and regular way of doing things, could Putin be entertaining the Board of Peace simply because it is a low-key way to motivate Trump to help the Russian cause, albeit somewhat unrelated?
Well, I think that so far the Russians haven't said that they're going to join the Board of Peace. What they're trying to use the whole issue for is to get Trump to issue an executive order to relax or to end the sanctions, even if only temporarily, on the Russian assets frozen in the United States. Of course, the moment that happens, that has enormous legal implications for the Russian assets frozen in Europe. That's the Russian game plan.
And that is the live stream, an epic live stream. That was a great live stream, everybody.
It's absolutely great questions. An enjoyable one, yeah.
Absolutely an enjoyable one. You might want to get Willie OAM on from Alexander. Yes, we've already talked about Willie OAM, and I've already said, please, if anyone knows how to get in touch with him, for him to reach out, we would be more than happy to get him on to provide a different perspective on the Ukraine-Russia war. So absolutely. That's everything, Alexander. But no, not everything. From Nikos, can you check your email contact for the lists? Absolutely, Nikos, we will check. And Sparky says, if you're bored of peace, try war. we'll end it on Sparky's super chat. Thank you to all the questions. Thank you to everyone that joined us on this live stream. Thank you to our awesome moderators. Alexander, just a final thought, and we're Audi 5000. Your thought of what's going to happen next? I like Alex's sunglasses on the Walk and Talk videos because it's very appropriate. We're going to be selling sunglasses. We're going to be selling ties. We'll do something so we can get some cool merch out to everybody.
Anyway, absolutely. Of course. Well, I mean, you know, we're on the brink of another war. The president of peace starts yet another war. I mean, there is something frenetic about all of this over the last few months. Trump is giving more and more of the impression of being a man in a hurry. And it's never good to be in a hurry. And I noticed that the Russians themselves about the negotiations are saying this. The negotiations between Putin and the Americans and the Russians and the Americans are over Ukraine. And when the Russians say that the other side is in a hurry, that means that they're seeing weakness.
Pathetic Albion says, very good discussion, Alex and Alexander. Thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you to everyone that joined us on Locals. Thank you to Tejano Ruski, who says, prior to Alexander Mercuris, the English had only three accomplishments that the rest of the world benefited from. Number one is cuss words. Number two is football. And number three is drum and bass. However, now there are four.
Except I'm not English. Remember that. I'm Greek.
Greek, English.
Greek, I'm British.
British. Yeah. Oh, yes, very true. Okay, great. Thank you for that, Tejano Ruski. All right, everybody, have a great day. And me and Alexander are going to publish some videos on our channels. Go to Alexander's channel. If you haven't already, go to his channel, subscribe, and go to my channel as well. And if you haven't, please subscribe there as well. Take care, everybody. Thank you.